more after all these flights are deemed successful by NASA. So first they're going to launch a crewed vehicle with nobody in it, and then eventually after that, they're going to launch two astronauts. I believe one is from the company, and the other astronaut will be from NASA. And that holds true for both space vehicles, the Starliner CST-100 and the Dragon crew vehicle. So that's the deal on that. The next flight that I'm interested in is a couple of flights in China launching rockets and more European Space Agency launches in Russia. But the one that I'm interested in seeing get off the ground is the Parker solar mission to the sun. It was delayed again, but not by much, just by a couple of days. It should have gone off the very beginning of August. Now we've got shifted to August 11th. It's going to be a Saturday. And unfortunately, it's going to be very early in the morning, Eastern Standard Time, 3:48. So if nobody wants to get up at that time, we'll be able to see it on the NASA replays. Since it's a NASA mission, they'll have it live, and they'll also have many, many replays of the Delta IV Heavy launching this thing from Launch Complex 37 down in Florida. That's three Delta IV rockets, big rockets, bolted together with a second stage, a Centaur upper stage on top. Centaur is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And for that matter, the three core stages that are going to be going up, the three booster stages, I guess you would call them, the Delta IVs, are also liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. They use a different engine than the shuttle. The shuttle had all liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engines. Also, they had the RS-25. This is the RS-68, so it's kind of like the shuttle ones. The shuttle ones were made to be reusable. These are not. These go down the drink after they launched them. So it's a little different setup. To cool the engine, they have an ablative system that burns off as it launches. So it doesn't look as clean as a shuttle launch with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. It's more, it looks like mostly a cloud of steam coming out. Where the RS-68 has slightly yellowish appearance, a lot of flames when it takes off. Quite dramatic. And the reason for that is this ablative material is burning off as it takes off. Okay, another topic is another company called Astrobotic. That's the company that's building a lunar lander. Relatively small lunar lander. I think it's only 1,000 pounds or so. And the lander is called the Peregrine. Peregrine has been under development by this company like for 8 years or so. And the company was originally developing one type of lunar lander called the Griffin. They've done away with that. And, they had one engine on it for a landing. This one is using five engines. Each one is around 150 pounds of thrust. Doesn't sound like much, but when you're coming in for a lunar lander, landing with only 1,000 pounds, you don't need that much. They plan on launching this next year on they got a ride on the Falcon 9 with SpaceX. Correction, the Peregrine. I had that backwards. Not SpaceX. They're going up on an Atlas V. They had a deal with they were going to go on SpaceX. That'll change. They're now going to ride on an Atlas V by the United Launch Alliance. That's a combination of Boeing and Lockheed. It's called the ULA, and they launch all these different types of rockets, including the Atlas V and the Delta IV, and they're the ones that are building the Vulcan rocket that's being developed that will eventually replace the Atlas V. And to make a long story short, Peregrine lander, they expect it to land on the moon and take pictures, and this company plans on eventually using it for bringing cargo and stuff to the moon. So we'll see how Astro Robotic does with their Peregrine lander. Let's see. I'm going to talk about politics very little bit. The Senate wants to keep... They're going to keep the... they would like to keep the ISS up there. Right now, the original plans are to deorbit it in 2024. I knew that wasn't going to work out. Too many people want this to stay up there. But usually they extend these things by 4 years. For some reason, the Senate is going to make this, or try to make this go to 2030. So they're going to push it out another 6 years instead of 4 years, which would be good. You know, a lot of private companies are still interested in running tests and experiments aboard the space station. And we don't have a private space station up there yet. True, there's going to be a Chinese one, but nobody in America, the American companies would rather deal with the United States. In fact, there might be regulations against doing something like that. Russians don't have one yet. Their plan is eventually to have a space station. And the private ones that are under development here haven't been launched. One in particular made by Bigelow. Bigelow is the company that makes these expandable modules. They still have plans on doing it. They have deals with United Launch Alliance to eventually launch their big version of the B-330. They call it, that's 330 square meters. Essentially, you would be, it's big enough to have six people stay on board. It's a very large module after it's inflated. But it's not up there yet, so that leaves the ISS, which is a good thing. You know, that's composed of around 10 or so livable modules. You could put six people on board, which is what we have now, and eventually there's going to be a steady seven-person crew on board the space station. And hopefully that'll happen within probably a year or two once the commercial flights start to get going. Okay, another spacecraft that we followed quite a bit here on the net is the TESS spacecraft. TESS was launched by NASA. It's called, it stands for Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Now that thing has been doing very good. It goes out to around where the moon orbit is, that far out, and then comes back. And it comes back to only around 60,000 miles off the surface of the Earth, and then it goes back out to 250,000 miles. So 60,000 miles is way above the geosynchronous satellite, so it won't interfere with that when it comes close to Earth. And this type of orbit, we've discussed this orbit before, enables TESS to stay stable with very little fuel at all. A stable orbit for at least 10 years. It's kind of like in a polar orbit of the Earth, so it goes out to the lunar distance. When it gets, by the time it gets out to that distance, the moon is nowhere near it. It's 90 degrees in front of its of where it's located. And then the next time it comes out to the moon orbit again, 14 days, actually 13.7 days later, roughly every 14 days, the moon is then on the other side of the 90 degrees behind it. So at one point it's pulling forward a little bit in its orbit when it gets out that far from the lunar gravity, and 2 weeks later, it's being pulled back in the opposite direction. So this push and pull action will go on for at least 10 years. It has on board four charge couple device cameras, CCDs. They're all like ganged together. If you were to look at it, it looks like there's like a square of, you know, of cameras. But the way they have it set up, it's looking out into space, and you're seeing one. If you were to look at the what it's taking a picture of, it, you're looking at one frame, and the next camera's got the next frame above that, and the next one above that. So you have four that are constantly being taken at every second, and this goes on from, you know, the whole orbital trip, you know, from one end to the other, and it's doing all the science research for most of the time, but the last, I think it's 8 or 9 hours, when it's closest to Earth, and not that close, it's 60,000 miles out. In fact, they need the deep space network to use that, because it's going to have such a high volume of data that's coming back. What TESS is looking at is all these stars, and the nearby stars to us, you know, a couple hundred light years out, for instance, it'll be looking at stars that are very close to us, you know, Wolf 359, and, you know, Barnard star, and thousands of other stars. I think they plan on looking at roughly 200,000 stars, and their prediction is that over the next couple of years, they'll be able to discover thousands of planets, Jupiter-sized, but also Earth-sized. And the way they're doing that is very similar to the Kepler mission that basically had charged a couple devices like this, photo detectors, and they could detect the light source of each star. And if it dimmed a little bit, and it did that on a regular basis, they knew that it had a planet in orbit. So the nice thing about this, these are going to be looking at the ones that are relatively close by compared to Kepler, which looked at for a lot of the time when it was staring at the one spot in space, maybe 1,500 light years away. This is going to be looking at hundreds of light years away, so relatively close. So what's going to happen is, once they launch the James Webb Space Telescope, because of TESS, they're going to have great targets to look at, concentrate with the James Webb Space Telescope, and possibly even see some type of a planet, or at least detect what kind of atmosphere it might have, that type of thing, whether or not it has a moon. This is all going on now. TESS is finally in operation after a couple of months. There were no delays. They expected it would take this long to qualify TESS, you know, for its science portion of it, of its mission. So that'll be good to start to see results. Right now, it's actually today. It's actually taking pictures and looking at the sky, and I believe another week or so from now, it'll be back near Earth, and then they'll actually start transmitting the data back to I believe mission control for this is, I believe it's in Goddard, but I'll have to check. I believe that's where they transmit the data to. So that's the deal on that. Now, another spacecraft that we keep covering that's under development is something called Unity. Unity is the spacecraft that's eventually going to carry 8 people, 2 pilots, you know, a pilot and co-pilot, and 6 paying passengers in the back. And it's a space plane that's attached to a carrier jet called the White Knight. And this is the one that goes up to 45,000 feet. they drop it from the carrier jet, it lights its one motor, and the rocket pushes it to the beyond the edge of space, not into orbit, but into suborbital flight. You get about 3, 4, 7 minutes, maybe they say, of weightlessness, and then you'll come back and land on the runway. They did another flight 2 days ago, another test flight. This is the third one with the rocket attached. Each time they're going higher and higher. This one I think they got up to around 50, I think they said 52 kilometers, which is roughly halfway to where they need to go. They need to go all the way out to 100 kilometers, a little bit better than that, to officially get into space. So it was very successful. The two pilots on board, they said it was great. Nothing really different about this flight. They're just leaving the rocket engine on a longer period of time, getting higher and higher on each test until they get up to that 100 kilometer location. After that, I guess they'll certify it, and he's got 650 people, and I say he, Richard Branson, he's the owner or part owner of Virgin Galactic. I think he's got 30% of it now, I think. The rest of it is also being, you know, there's investors involved. So, not to be outdone, he's got to be, you know, with his one spacecraft, he's got two more that he's presently building, identical to Spaceship Two. They'll be giving it different names, of course, but, you know, it's a nice looking rocket. I like the idea that, you know, you can go up and come back and land on a runway. Is it going to be dangerous? It could be, but if all goes right, he's going to be doing this on a regular basis. And like I said, 650 people are lined up to go into space. Eventually, they will actually be astronauts. They will be tourists, but they will qualify, and they will be able to say that they're astronauts, that they've gone into space by paying this large sum of money to not go into orbit, but still. So inside of, let's see, it's 60 years today that NASA really got started, and we're up to around a little over 500 people that have flown in space. If this guy has his way, and he's not taking any more new tickets because he wants to go through all these people before he takes any more money from anybody else. You know, within a couple of years, if he can get his other spacecraft built, he'll have three going at one time. Before you know it, they're going to double that number. Instead of 500, you're going to have 1,000 people that have qualified as being in space. So I thought I'd bring that up. His next test, I think, is another month or so away. And with that, they're going to leave the engine on. I think they said 15 seconds longer. And I think there's one more test after that they have to do. So that's pretty good. That's pretty much it. I want to bring up one topic that has really nothing to do with the space program, but I was going to mention it before on Dixnet, but I forgot about it. Radio Shack, which is, as far as I'm concerned, out of business, has a deal with a company called Hobby Town. Now, there are no Hobby Towns on Long Island, but apparently they're through the country. And Radio Shack plans on opening these things for hobbyists, you know, people that want to go in and get a transistor or something for that type of customer. I read this I think yesterday or the day before. I was quite surprised to read this, so I'll have to see how this eventually plays out. What we need now is a hobby town on Long Island or Queens or Nassau or wherever you're listening to us, Canada. So that's pretty much it, Dick, for the space portion of the TechNet. We'll turn it back to you or anybody else for any questions. K K2RIW. This has been WS2N.
Let's see if we have any further questions on any of the above. If so, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW. TSS, TESS, as I remember, is going to go, I think it's doing something similar to Gaia, but doing it more accurately or more thorough. In other words, it's going to measure a very large number of stars and determine their distance and position and rate of motion. Is that basically true, Paul, K2RIW?
Yeah, Gaia, well, first of all, Gaia is out at the L2 position, Lagrange point 2, a million miles away from Earth. And Gaia is pretty much doing a 3D survey of the, it's called the universe, looking out of, and it's determining the distances of these stars somehow. I guess maybe it's using Doppler, I'm not sure what it's doing, but I've seen some results from Gaia, and you know, they say after it's done, you'll be able to almost like, you know, travel through space, not go anywhere, but you know, as if you were in a spaceship, you'll be able to see what things look like three dimensionally as far as the stars are concerned, and the I guess the galaxies, where TESS is primarily a planet hunter, similar to Kepler, back to you there.
Okay, so what Gaia is going to be and Gaia is going to be doing when they finish, we've all seen science fiction programs in which the spacecraft appears to be flying through a group of stars. In reality, the distance between the stars is so great that this is very unlikely. You'd have to be flying at a zillion times the speed of light. But we've seen these computer-generated graphics where you watch those stars whipping by you as you're moving by in your spacecraft in this sci-fi. When Gaia finishes doing its measurements, that kind of computer-generated graphics, instead of it being a story, could be reality. In other words, the real individual stars at their real individual positions would be going flying by you if you could be moving that fast. So, Gaia's been up there how long, and sounds like it's doing very good work. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, it's been up there a while. I wonder if it's 6 or 7 years. Track of time as far as when that went up. I can check real quick on Wikipedia. It's best for that type of thing. But first couple of years, they had problems getting it operating. They had some kind of problem. I think it was one of the cameras or something wasn't working right. They eventually worked out what whatever this was. Something floated around maybe from the launch or something. I don't recall. But they had problems. It took them like a year and a half or something to straighten it out. Maybe the temperature on board or something was affecting things. Something wasn't right, and you can't go out, like Roy said, you can't go out to L2 and fix anything. So whatever they did, they did from Earth. So, yeah. There's been quite a few out there. Planck was out there at L2. Herschel was out there at L2. And they've moved them out of the way to make room for Gaia and to make room for future missions like James Webb Space Telescope. And that one that Roy was talking about, WFIRST, that they're thinking possibly of canceling. They've cut back on the funds on that thing. That's possibly also going out to L2, where originally that was supposed to be in Earth orbit. So I guess they'll eventually make up their mind on that. That's an infrared telescope as well. And that's going to be in the $3 billion category. Well, that beats $10 billion. Let me drop it. Oh, I have one other topic I was going to cover. I thought Roy was going to do this. This has to do with the Brookhaven lab. just have, I got to mention, this is Long Island. Brookhaven Lab wants to change the RIC program, the RHIC, that's the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. They want to change it to an Electron Ion Collider, something a little different, for like $750 million. So I'm hoping that this goes through. Essentially, they're going to be changing one of the rings that go around RIC. RIC is a super collider. It's got a circumference of 2.5 miles. I've been out there. I actually worked in there doing mechanical work, nothing to do with the collider itself, but I got to see it. And originally, it was called Isabel. I was out there for that, too. Let me drop it.
And was it ever called the alternating gradient synchrotron? Isn't that same 2.5 mile diameter ring? Hasn't it been resurrected a number of times under a number of different names? Oh, Paul, go ahead.
Maybe they were going to use that name at one time. I don't remember that name. I know back in the 70s they had Isabel, and it was the intersecting storage accelerator plus the word Bell at the end. So they called it Isabel. And they built it. I mean, they built this big ring, big tunnel. They started doing some insulation. I was out there doing some heating piping for one of the detecting areas. And then next thing you know, they shut it all down. But I guess Congress pulled the rug out from under them. I mean, it never happened. And then years went by into the 80s and whatever it was, I guess the early 90s. And they used that same tunnel and put in a big, RIC, well, now I remember what it was, the Isabel problem had to do with magnets, the superconducting magnets weren't perfected back then. Then when they worked on that and eventually got it, they used that system for the relativistic heavy ion collider. It's out there today that they eventually wanted to change this new one, some kind of a electron collider. I think that's the history on Brookhaven. Whatever it is, it's Long Island, so I hope they do it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I vaguely remember this. This change is a proposal, and I think the change proposal is in competition with another collider that's in, is it Maryland or Virginia? Go ahead.
Yeah, that was someplace in Virginia. Begin with an F. But yeah, they have another deal down there. We'll have to find out which one wins. I guess they're in competition with that one in Virginia. But you've got a lot of brain power here. I don't know what they got there, but it's a city. We're near the city. They should definitely use Brookhaven. You know, you got a massive place out there. There's other things out there in Brookhaven, too. You know, it's not just that collider. They have other things, the light source deal that they have that they accelerate things with. Use RF to do that, too. You've got a lot of science in Brookhaven.
I think in the summertime, Brookhaven tends to have an open house. I think it's weekends. There's probably been a couple of them already this summer. Is that true, Paul?
Yes, I missed today. Today they had the light source tour. You know, you go out there for an hour. And a lot of walking, so I don't know if I'm up to that, but quite a bit of walking. I think it's equivalent to walking, if you go from area to area, it's like they said it's like walking a half a mile or so. But yeah, that's... That was today. I guess I don't know what the rest of the schedule is for the rest of the summer.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you. What's going on next week and the week after that, if you happen to know?
No, I'd have to check their website.
So if we simply go to the Brookhaven Laboratory website, I guess they're going to tell us all about this. And I presume some of these programs are oriented toward... high school as well as more senior people?
Yeah, I would say from grade school all the way up. You know, the tours are pretty good. And, you know, there's questions and answers. And I think you've been on that. So, you know, it's not over everybody's head, that's for sure. You know, they're not going to have a scientist come out and start giving you formulas, you know.
Each time I go to Brookhaven Lab, and when you get a chance to go into some of their buildings, particularly where people have their offices, quite often on the walls and the halls between the buildings, they have some very nice charts, I'm going to call them, and all kinds of good scientific data with multicolors on these charts. And if you look at the information in the corners, you can easily find out where to order those charts. They're usually not very expensive, but some of them are very nice to have. So, have we run out of space report material, Paul? And if so, nothing magic. We can end a little bit early tonight. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yes, I don't have anything else. Let me just look. Nope, I got through everything. We're good, Dick. Back to you.
Let's see if Roy wants to add anything. I think he's going through his list. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
No, actually, I cut it short because of time. Matter of fact, I have a story on the electron collider and the other place is the Thomas Jefferson National Accelerator Laboratory in Newport News, Virginia.
And I presume we're in competition with them. It sure would be nice to think that we lead a little bit. So if you want to give us some of the details of that story, go right ahead, Roy.
Okay. I think it's kind of early, unfortunately. The study just reported out that they approved the concept, but they didn't really even think about where they would have it done and such. So it's sort of early, but we'll cross our fingers and hope for the best. And let me pull down my little thing that I had written up for this. One sec. Let me drop for a sec.
Oh, I did have one topic left. I knew there was something. WS2N.
Hey, Paul, if you want to do your topic, I can always do this next week.
There might be enough time for both. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, this is relatively short. On the 31st, this Tuesday, 8 a.m. in the morning, NASA will have it on TV. It's a sounding rocket, you know, it goes off from Wallops, Virginia. You know, it's only going to go up to around, I believe, 35 miles high, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's high enough to do what they need to do with this. They're testing a parachute. The name of this launch is called Aspire 3. Well, it was an Aspire 1, Aspire 2, and this one's an Aspire 3, and they launch them by these rockets. Sounding rockets. It's a two-stage rocket. You have the, you've got the Terrier Black brand 9. It's a rocket they've been using for quite a few years. And over the years, they've upgraded it. But it's launching this Aspire, the Advanced Supersonic Parachute Inflation Research Experiment. It's the same parachute that will be going on the 2020 lander that will land on Mars, and they want to test the strength of all these. They make these changes to these ropes and the material and their size, and each time they do it, this is the third test, and they're up to, I think they said 70,000 pounds of force will be against these ropes. You know, they need to be able to know it's safe. And the numbers are going to be much higher than what's really going to happen on Mars. But they need to know it's safe. So they have this weight on top, this dart-like thing, and it's duplicating the lander as it's coming down through the atmosphere of Mars. And they go up to that height because that's roughly the height that... we're going to start getting the same, the equivalent atmosphere when you first go into Mars, and then this one big parachute is eventually going to open. And the last two were very successful, and this is the third one that they're doing. But it's amazing to watch this rocket take off. I mean, it goes off like a bullet. You know, there's a big difference between these launches and these great big launches. That was it. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, thank you. Paul, go right ahead. Roy.
Okay, the science questions that could be answered by an electron-ion collider, a very large-scale particle accelerator, are significant to advancing our understanding of the atomic nuclei that make up all visible matter in the universe. There's a new report by the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Beyond impact on nuclear science, the advances made possible by an electron-ion collider could have far-reaching benefits to the nation's science and technology-driven economy, as well as also maintaining a U.S. leadership in nuclear physics and in collider accelerator technologies in general. The National Academies were asked by the U.S. Department of Energy to examine the scientific importance of an electron-ion collider, as well as international implications of building a domestic electron-ion collider facility. That conducted the study and wrote the report concluded that the science that could be addressed by an electron-ion collider is compelling and would provide long, elusive answers on the nature of matter. An electron-ion collider would allow scientists to investigate where quarks and gluons, the tiny particles that make up neutrons and protons, are located inside the protons and neutrons, how they move, how they interact with each other. While the famous Higgs mechanism explains the masses of quarks, the most significant portion of the mass of protons or neutrons, about 99%, comes from its gluon interactions. Crucial questions that an electron-ion collider would answer, hopefully, include the origin of the mass of atomic nuclei, the origin of neutrons and protons, a fundamental property that makes magnetic resonance imaging possible, how gluons hold nuclei together, and whether emergent forms of matter made of dense gluons can exist. The report says a new electron-ion collider accelerator facility would have capabilities beyond all previous electron scattering machines in the U.S., Europe, and Asia. Let me drop.
Repeater, time out.
Well, high energies and luminosities, the measure of the rate at which particle collisions occur, are required to achieve the fine resolution needed. And to reach each intensity and energy level requires a collider where beams of electrons smash into beams of protons or heavier ions. Comparing all existing and proposed accelerator facilities around the world, the committee concluded that an electron-ion collider with high energy and luminosity and highly polarized electron and ion beams would be unique and in a position to greatly further our understanding of visible matter. Let me drop. An electron-ion collider would be the most sophisticated and challenging accelerator currently proposed for construction in the U.S. and would significantly advance accelerator science and, more specifically, collider science and technologies here and around the world, said the committee co-chairman Gordon Boehm, Center of Advanced Studies Professor Emeritus. The realization of an electron-ion collider is absolutely crucial to maintaining the health of the field of nuclear physics in the United States and would open up new areas of scientific investigation. Currently, the Brookhaven National Laboratory here in Long Island, New York, has a heavy ion collider, and the Thomas Jefferson National Accelerator Laboratory in Newport News, Virginia, has a very energetic electron beam. Let me drop. Both labs have proposed design concepts for an electron-ion collider that would use their already available infrastructure, expertise, and experience. The report, without favoring one over the other, says to take advantage of the existing facilities would make development of an electron-ion collider cost-effective and reduce associated risks that come with building a large accelerator facility. While both labs have well-developed designs for an electron-ion collider, both would require considerable research and development to fully deliver on the compelling science questions. The report states that the Department of Energy's research and development investment has and would continue to be crucial to minimizing design risks in a timely fashion and to addressing standing accelerator challenges. Let me drop. The committee added that along with advancing nuclear science, an electron ion collider would also benefit other areas such as astrophysics, particle physics, accelerator physics, and theoretical and computational modeling. It would also play a valuable role in sustaining the U.S. nuclear physics workforce in the coming decades. Moreover, it would have a significant role in advancing more broadly the technologies that would result from the research and development undertaken in the implementation and construction of an electron ion collider in the United States. The report emphasizes that an electron ion collider is the only high energy collider being planned for construction in the United States currently, and building such a facility would maintain U.S. leadership in accelerated collider science while benefiting the physical sciences. And I will have a link on this as well.
I think I've read, Roy, that part of what that machine is slated to do is to essentially look inside of protons and neutrons to really find out what all the components in there are doing. I think I remember reading that if you take the known mass of each of the components inside of a proton and a neutron, add them all together, you don't get the same mass of what the whole proton or neutron is. Am I remembering that wrong? Back to you, Roy.
Well, you are quite right. A lot of people will go on and on about Higgs bosons, but unfortunately, Higgs bosons can only explain approximately 1% the mass of a neutron or a proton. It does a very good job on electrons, but it does a terrible job on protons and neutrons. Usually, the explanation goes into the binding energy of the quarks involved, but that doesn't really add up either. And if you push physicists very hard, they will start to glaze over and tell you about virtual gluon quark objects, particles within the neutron and the proton that are going in and out of existence, adding their virtual masses to the totality of a neutron and proton. So that's the fuzzy answer you're getting this week. They really want more information. They want a better explanation of why the heck neutrons and protons are 10 times heavier than Higgs forces would suggest. Even with binding energy, it doesn't really make up the answer for 100%. You have to throw in virtual particles, and some people don't like virtual particles.
The way you said 10 times, does that mean that we can account for roughly 10% of the mass inside of a neutron and a proton, and 90% of the mass, so to speak, appears to be missing?
I wouldn't say missing. It's just unexplained, unfortunately. It's another one of these gaps where you've added up the total amount of mass energy in the universe, and you seem to only have 5% that's visible in any place. It gets embarrassing. So we don't quite know what's making up that mass again. The easiest answer physicists will throw at you is virtual gluon quarks that are existing for infinitesimal instants of time within the fabric of any neutron proton in any nucleus all over the world and such. But it's not a very fulfilling answer, so they're looking for something better, I think.
So most of the galaxy seems to have dark matter that's unaccounted for. Are protons and neutrons also having dark matter that's unaccounted for, Roy?
No, they're not pulling dark matter out of that because it's visible. They just don't know quite how to explain it. Again, the general consensus of theoreticians this week is that it's virtual particles do have an effect. There are all kinds of physical experiments that demonstrate that the only way to explain it is if virtual particles come in and out of existence and interact with the real world. So there's a case to be made of virtual particle pair adding some kind of mass in objects. It's just not the warmest and fuzziest solution to the problem. But thankfully they're not adding it to dark energy or dark matter, because then instead of 5% of the mass energy in the universe that we could see, it would shrink down to an even smaller number. And I'm not that happy with 5% personally.
You mentioned magnetic resonance imaging. It used to be called nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR, and now it's called MRI. The NMR machine is doing what to the nucleus, to the protons, and to the neutrons in order to do that visualization? Is there a simple way of adding a few words to that crazy question, Paul? KGYIW.
Basically, the concept is just as electrons have something called quantum spin, protons and neutrons have something called spin. It's not the same thing as orbital momentum, because if you try and tack orbital momentum to those sizes and those velocities, nothing makes any sense. But we call it spin nevertheless. And in magnetic resonance imaging, what you end up doing is you set up a polarity of the magnetic moment of a nucleus, and then you inject radio frequency enough to excite the nucleus to spin in the opposite direction, and you detect the drop of the RF being absorbed in order to rotate, shift the rotation of the nuclear spin.
And so the density of various substances like oxygen, water, or whatever is what you're actually imaging when you're doing imaging with an MRI machine?
Not actually the density. It's more the magnetic moment, and different nuclei have different resonances, RF and magnetic moments. And so you can differentiate different type of nucleuses and different bonds of the nucleus based upon the slightly different frequencies at which they absorb energy and rotate in another direction. Ultimately, we don't know a lot of what's going on in the very guts of the nucleus. We have a very nice idea about orbitals of electrons, probability shells, spins, and all kinds of things. But really, when you get down to the nucleus, it's all kind of fuzzy and vague.
The imaging you get out of an MRI, is it primarily hydrogen imaging or oxygen imaging? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, because it's the easiest thing to play around with the magnetic resonance of water molecules and the density of water molecules in organ systems, and that's kind of the easiest way of approaching it. Theoretically, as they design faster and more versatile MRIs, they may find other atoms, nucleuses, that are possibly offering more information if they change in the images. But, you know, the most easiest is the simple organic compounds in our body.
Okay, so please send your questions over to Roy at mail at ac2gs.com. That was technet number 1709. That was space report number 179. That was Science Talk number 139. 73, you all. Bye-bye, and we'll see you next week. K2RI to be clear.
Have a good night, Dick, Roy, everybody else that's listening. We'll be back next week. WS20.